we're guilty of false advertising. This is not Revelation, but Exodus. It was originally advertised as a session on Revelation. The sessions on Revelation will begin tomorrow. And I am not Dan Erlander. I'm Joe Barnt. And we're going to look at Exodus through the eyes of the Pharaoh. And I have to warn you, this morning I was in the bookstore and I bought my poetic license. So I may sorry about that. So you may need to follow with your own Bibles if you like to make sure I don't misuse my, take too much poetic license with the Bible. I'd like to state a principle of biblical interpretation and then illustrate it with Exodus. I won't try and prove the principle. I think it holds true through the whole of the Bible, but I won't try and prove it or demonstrate it. I'd just like to give one illustration of it. You can test in your own minds whether you think it's a valid one and whether or not it's applicable to the Exodus or any other part of the Bible. It comes from the principle that that Jim and Marva emphasized yesterday, that that in biblical studies, before we can begin to find something of the meaning of the Bible for us, we have to find some way to get back to the original meaning, and especially the original context within which that was written. What was meant by the people who wrote it then. And the principle that comes from that that I like to emphasize is that one of the main contexts of the writing of the Bible, almost solidly, straight on through, is that it was written within the context and the experience of people who were living in conditions of poverty and oppression and injustice and brokenness. Almost all the way through, the people about whom the Bible was written, the people within whom the experience was taking place. John Schramm and others I've heard say very clearly that the Bible is a third world book, that if it were written today, it would be written by people in countries of Asia and Latin America and Africa, and maybe from Southside Chicago in the South Bronx, but it's a third world book and a third world situation, and that we need to get back to that original context, need to think reading through the eyes of the poor and the oppressed and what the Bible means to them in order to be able to get closer to the context, closer to the context of the Bible. Some of you may know Bishop Dom Elder Camara is, is it tonight that, America is being shown? Or is it? Friday. Pardon?
No, it's Friday.
They're going to show it again. Is today Thursday? Friday? What's today?
Thursday.
Tomorrow night. They're going to show it again tomorrow night. It's a movie of Bishop Dom Elder Camara. He's sort of the Martin Luther King of Northeast Brazil, if you will. One time an American woman went up to him and said, Dom Elder, every time you speak of the biblical texts, it all becomes so very, very clear to us. And yet our preachers and pastors and priests in the United States, when they get up in their pulpits and preach, they go on for hours and it's still as unclear as it ever was to us. How come you make it so clear? And he said, it has nothing to do with my preaching ability. It's that when you read the Bible from the context of the poor, you don't even need a sermon. The Bible becomes clear. And then he said, I'm afraid that what happens in our rich congregations is that the preachers spend most of their time turning the Bible around so that it can be consistent with the life of the rich people in the powerful countries. And so that, he said, what we have to do is to turn it back around and look at the Bible through the eyes of the poor. Or another way of saying the same thing, perhaps, is that there are two kinds of people in the world. Those who say there are two kinds of people in the world and those who don't. there are two kinds of people in the world, and they are not good and evil, broken and whole, sinful, rather sick and well, or oppressor and oppressed. That's not the division of the world into those categories. But rather the world can be divided into those people who are not able to cover up their brokenness and those who are. Those who have the money and the power and the skills and the education to disguise brokenness and to pretend the brokenness and the sickness and the need for restoration is not there. And so Jesus constantly was saying, I didn't come for the sick, rather for the well, I came for the sick. And so if you're going to come to me and say you ain't sick, then you didn't need me. And he did that with the Pharisees and John when he said, we've never been enslaved. Jesus said, I'm going to set you free. And so he can't set somebody free who claims to have never been enslaved. And the Pharisees said, we're children of Abraham and Sarah. We've never been enslaved. So Jesus had to deal with their covering up and pretending and disguising their need for it. And I suppose what Bishop Dom Elder meant was that the way we are capable in our society with our stacking up of our degrees, our PhDs and our MSWs and whatever, and our doctors of divinity and our accomplishments and all the things we've done with our life and our possessions, our housing, our cars, our clothing, our wearing of Jordache jeans, so that even from the back we look good. And all of those things to disguise that we are what a severely handicapped or disabled person friend of mine says refers to me as the temporarily able-bodied people, and the people who spend most of our time or a good deal of our time disguising our need for being made whole again, and so long as we do that. With that disguise on, the Bible cannot make sense to us. And that it's only when we find some way of returning to the original context of the Bible being written about people primarily who are in poverty and oppression, injustice, brokenness, who need to be set free, and maybe seeing the Bible also through the eyes of the poor and the broken and the oppressed today, that it begins to make sense to us. Okay, I'd like to... as an illustration of that, just look a little bit at the Exodus story. I prefer having about 2 days to do this, so in some ways it might be a little bit sketchy, but I'd like to take you a little bit through some of it. Just simply the approach to the Exodus story makes a difference from the perspective of the way we look at it, and I think the way it was originally written, and the way third world people from Asia, Africa, Latin America look at it today. For us, the Christian identity has always been closely associated with the Exodus, and we usually speak about our spiritual identification with the Hebrew people. That we, in the Hebrew people and in the story of the Exodus, discover the roots of our own Passover, and our new covenanted relationship with God in the New Testament and in the upper room, we trace back to the very roots of the Passover itself in the Exodus. For Christians in the third world today, it goes much deeper, as well as for poor and oppressed in past generations, like, for example, the slave people in the United States before 1860, and black people and others struggling for justice in the United States today. For them, the account is more than a story of spiritual liberation. It's a history of physical oppression, political and economic oppression, and of struggle for political and economic liberation. And unless we begin to reread the Exodus story as a liberation struggle for political and economic freedom, out of which comes a new spiritual identification of a people, we're told by third world people, at least, we've missed the major point of the whole story. And perhaps our ability to comprehend that kind of a perspective requires our de-spiritualizing or our re-politicizing much of the scriptural account. For example, when we begin to look at the Exodus story, and if you have Bibles and want to just open to 1:1 or... actually 1:6. Remember that the book of Genesis ends exactly where the book of Exodus begins, with the death of Joseph. You remember Joseph, through a lot of historical reasons, and his whole family, and therefore the people of Israel, Jacob, came down to Israel. For a while they were honored guests there. And that's a little different from from the bringing of slaves here to the United States, but in many, many other ways, there's lots of parallels, as I think you'll hear from this. But the one difference between bringing slaves here to the United States and the story of black liberation here is that the people of Israel were honored guests in Egypt for a long time. And some people estimate, and it's an interesting parallel if it is, that the time of the people of Israel being in Egypt was about 400 years. And black people in the United States like to think of that time as being probably fairly accurate because it makes another historical parallel to their own experience of being here for 400 years. But what I'd like to just show in reading this is some of the distinct parallels in language and concepts and understanding of oppression that are revealed in the Exodus story and how it so much parallels the experience of oppression by many people today also. Not just simply a historical parallel, but the language and the conceptual understanding of oppression. Well, in verse 1-6, the same as the end of Genesis itself, in course of time, Joseph and his brothers and all the rest of the generation died. But their descendants of the Israelites had many children and became so numerous and strong that Egypt was filled with them. And then a new king who knew nothing about Joseph came to power in Egypt. And he said to his people, and it's at this point then that the oppression, the story of the oppression of these honored guests begins. And what happens here is very, very comparable to oppression in our own day-to-day, is that oppressing people have a great fear of the people they are oppressing and have a great deal of need to keep them under control. And more than anything else, and it happens in almost every story historically that you can read about a people oppressing the others, there's the fear of numbers, that they are going to grow so numerous and strong that they will become able to join our enemies and overpower us. And so just as people often express today, so also the Pharaoh kept talking about, you know, these people are grown like, are multiplying like rabbits. You know, you've heard that, haven't you? And we got to get some form of controlling the population growth, the population explosion, and before you know it, they're going to overwhelm us with numbers. That is not just something as common to our day. It goes all the way back to one of the earliest experiences of the oppressors, of the fear of numbers. And then there are, and as that begins to happen, there begins to develop in the mentality of the oppressor about ways to control the population. And so Pharaoh said to his people, "The Israelites are so numerous and strong that they are a threat to us. In case of war, they might join our enemies in order to fight against us and might escape from the country. We must find some way to keep them from being even more numerous." And so there are two methods that oppressors have used throughout history to control the population of the people that they are oppressing. And the first is work, hard labor. And that the labor of the slaves or of the oppressed people is not just to perform the economic function of supporting the oppressor society, which is the primary reason of having slaves or oppressed people then or today. This is the main reason for having oppressed people. But the other is to keep them so busy they haven't got time for sex, I guess. But for some reason, to keep them very, very busy, so they're going to go home and go tired and go to sleep, and they won't have time to have babies. So the Egyptians put slave drivers over them to crush their spirits with hard labor as a means of controlling the population. And the Israelites built the cities of Pithom and Ramses to serve as supply centers for the king. Or my text says king, that's the original translation, is Pharaoh. But the more the Egyptians oppressed the Israelites, the more they multiplied like rabbits. Oh, my text doesn't say that. The more they increased in number, and the farther they spread throughout the land. And the Egyptians came to fear the Israelites and made their lives miserable by forcing them into cruel slavery. They made them work on their building projects and in their fields, and they had no pity on them. And I think if we had time to just go into the mythology of population expansion, the mythology of work, the mythology in our minds of oppressed people being lazy and multiplying like rabbits, and somehow if they worked they wouldn't be having all these kids, is very directly here related, that you make them work hard, they'll start becoming responsible people, or they won't have time for sex, or for some reason they're not going to have babies. I'm not sure where all that myth comes from, but I think it's deeply ingrained in us, as much in us as it was in them. Then there's a second method of dealing with population expansion, of the population explosion that is very traditional throughout the centuries, and I believe is still with us today, and that is birth control. Pharaoh might have had a more severe method than that, but behind this theory is what I think that a lot of social psychologists and a lot of international experts believe is a twisting around of the idea of how to deal with the population explosion. It is the assumption, I think, that is pretty much spoken in our country and throughout the world, that one of the main things, and maybe for many people the main thing which must be done in order to deal with the underdevelopment of nations and of poor people throughout the world, is population control. Dealing with a population explosion. The assumption is that development will begin to take place when the population explosion is controlled. There is another assumption that is carried out by many social psychologists and many international experts, and that is that the reverse is true. And I think that also has something to do with our own experience also, as maybe one way of beginning to understand that, and that is that as people begin to develop, as people begin to have new power and control over their lives, that at that point, then populations begin to decrease in the population explosion by the very virtue of their not needing so many children. When amongst black people and Puerto Rican people and Chicano people in the United States, as well as when you travel through Latin America or Africa, they give a different story about population control than we do. They say that children are the basis to a life of a poor person. That when half of your children are going to die before you're five, you really have to have a lot of children to make sure you have children to grow up. And when your own security rests on having enough children who are going to support you when you haven't got social security, and when you haven't got any other means of sustaining yourself in your age, the building up of a family to take over and to provide for the rest of the family becomes a very, very important way of dealing with your needs. As a people begin to have greater control and over their own destiny, they begin to limit their own population. Well, you can read about both the argument about both of those theories and decide for yourself. It is quite obvious that the Pharaoh believed that population control was one of the major problems he had in dealing with oppressed people and from keeping them from taking over. And so in addition to making them work harder so they wouldn't have time to have babies, he began to develop a program of birth control. Then the king of Egypt spoke to Shifra and Puah, the two midwives who helped the Hebrew women. "When you help the Hebrew women give birth," he said to them, "kill the baby if it is a boy, but if it's a girl, let it live." Now, as you remember, that really becomes even more severe later, and that's the reason that Moses got down by the bulrushes, because he was supposed to have been dumped into the Nile and killed. This next portion of the text, however, tells something else about the relationship between the oppressor and the oppressed that's really important to the survival of oppressed people. And that's been as true in our day as it has been in past generations and in the time of the Exodus, and that is that the survival of oppressed people depends upon their being able to fool the oppressor. Some of you know the phrase in the black community in our society of shucking and jiving. The ability, we act as though that in past times in slavery or in today even, that we know oppressed people better than they know us. In fact, the opposite is true. Their survival is dependent upon their knowing us far better than we know them, and their being able to fool us. And exactly what happened here is one of the best instances I know of shucking and jiving that takes place in oppressed situations. So Pharaoh calls in the midwives, the Hebrew midwives, and says, "I give you my orders that you when you're helping your women give birth, if it's a male child, let it live. Now, if it's a male child, kill it. But the midwives were God-fearing, and so did not obey the king. Instead, they let the boys live. So the king sent for the midwives and asked them, "Why are you doing this? Why are you letting the boys live?" And here it comes. And they answered, "The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They give birth more easily, and their babies are born before either of us gets there." And the Pharaoh said, "Oh, I didn't know that." And so because the midwives were God-fearing, God was good to them and gave them families of their own. And the Israelites continued to increase and become strong. And finally, the king issued a command to all of his people, "Take every newborn Hebrew boy and throw him into the Nile, but let all the girls live." Now let's take a jump, because we don't have time to go through a great deal of the story. I want to take a jump to the fact that you remember the story, of course, and I don't have to read it or do much to recall it, and that is that Moses gets born, and he gets hidden by the bulrushes, and Miriam finds him. Miriam? Yeah, Miriam finds him, and adopts him, and Moses grows up an Egyptian. Now that's really an important concept, I think, in terms of a lot of the struggles that happen amongst us today. That Moses grows up and is born, and rather is raised and given an education and values of an Egyptian consciousness. In our society today, people from Black or Chicano or Puerto Rican communities or Native American communities say he grew up white. He was raised not with a consciousness of Black culture, or rather of Hebrew culture, or of Hebrew values, or of his Hebrew people, or of a slave consciousness, or of an oppressed consciousness. He grew up and was made into a person who had that other consciousness, the consciousness of the oppressor people, of the Egyptians. And what happened to Moses happened directly because he became aware, he had that conversion, and he had the transformation. He rediscovered his Hebrew identity and had a very traumatic experience on his life. Some of you may know Pastor Will Hertzfeld, who comes up here to Holden quite a bit. He's a Black pastor from Oakland, a Lutheran pastor, and he's vice president of the new AELC, a national vice president. And he talks about the fact that when he became a Lutheran pastor, he had to become a German first. They had, in those days, they had a Black seminary over in North Carolina someplace, in Missouri Synod, and there they prepared the Black pastors. And the part of the process of becoming a Lutheran in those days, and maybe still too much today, is that you got to become a German first. And when you don't come out of a German or Norwegian or Swedish or European background, that's a pretty traumatic transformation. Pardon?
Yeah.
Yes. and obviously, as some of us were talking yesterday afternoon, one of our needs as Lutherans is to get rid of the equal sign between European and Lutheran, or we will never become a multiracial, multicultural church. Well, Moses grew up white. There's another comparable kind of thing about what happened to Moses. In the women's liberation movement today, women talk about having, I think, what's called a click experience. When in the gaining of a consciousness of having been grown up, taught what it means to be a woman by male, by men and by male values, the rediscovery of who a woman is goes through a series of click experiences, as a lot of women talk about, of saying, aha, or, oh my gosh, I really believed those lies, the click experience. Well, that happened to Moses. He was out walking amongst the slaves, his own people, but not with the consciousness that these were his people, and he saw the foreman, the slave driver, beating up one of his Hebrew brothers, and the transformation took place in an instant. The click experience was one that just absolutely, not only in an instant, recalled to him his own Hebrewness, but drove him mad for an instant, and he killed the man who was beating his brother. And so the next place you see you see Moses in the middle of chapter 2, all that I just told, I could have told in about 30 seconds by reading the first half of chapter 2, that by chapter 2 verse 11, by the verse 17, Moses is in Midian, a political exile. Remember, we're reading Exodus as a story of political economic liberation, not just a story of spiritual discovery of relationship with God. And we need to understand, for example, the Chilean refugees who are here in the United States or in other parts of the world, who have had to escape from Chile and from many, many other places in the world, or from South Africa and so many places, are like Moses. They discovered their oppressed nature, they began to struggle for liberation, and in the process were forced into political exile, and are lucky they're not dead, because as soon as you speak the word freedom in front of an oppressor, murder comes to their eyes. Okay, then Moses is a Midian, and he marries, he gets married and raises a family, and and he stays in political exile waiting for the day. And remember that the parallel thing that's taking place is 400 years of oppression of a Hebrew people, you know, calling upon God. Remember, we were talking yesterday about those parables, about calling upon God, and he's going to answer you, be faithful in your prayers. For 400 years, waiting the day of liberation, and for 400 years, getting the strength of the power of God to endure and to survive and to wait until the day when the day of liberation will come. And the coincidence of those two stories of that waiting and praying and surviving and enduring of a people under the oppressor's hard taskmasters, and of Moses waiting in Midian for a day when, and the burning bush experience, and God says to Moses through the burning bush in his call to be the liberator of the people of Israel, "I have seen how cruelly my people are being treated in Egypt." And if you can hear, once again, read through the eyes of oppressed people, if you can read, listen to this through the eyes of a black person in the South Bronx, or a black South African in exile in Botswana, or a Chilean refugee here, or oppressed people all around the world. Listen to this through their eyes. "I have seen how cruelly my people are being treated in Egypt, or in South Africa, or in Chile, or wherever. I've heard their cry to be rescued from their slave drivers. I know all about their suffering, and so I have come." You can almost hear the Hebrew people saying, "Finally come." "And now I have come down to rescue them from the Egyptians and to bring them out of Egypt to a fertile and spacious land, one which is rich and fertile and in which the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites now live. I have indeed heard the cry of my people, and I see how the Egyptians are oppressing them. Now I am sending you to the king of Egypt so that you can lead my people out of his country." And then Moses, like Jonah and Peter and us, you know, sort of runs off at the mouth when God calls him to do something and tries to go the opposite way. And he says, I can't do it, you know. And so God has to send golden mouth Aaron to be his spokesperson for the movement, for the Hebrew liberation movement. But at that point, the Hebrew liberation movement begins. And I want to tell you one other thing, if I have time, about that. Because what happens in that story, and it's another direct parallel between oppressors and oppressed, that we begin to need to understand, I think, what we can learn from this about people struggling for liberation in our day. Somebody asked in our discussion yesterday, in talking about liberation struggles and combating racism in the United States, and said something about how black people and Chicanos in Los Angeles are always fighting each other, and there's a great enmity there. And in my experience in the South Bronx, which is 50% black and 50% Puerto Rican, is that they fight so much against each other, you wonder when they're going to get together and fight the real enemy. And And what happens when Moses begins to organize the Hebrew liberation movement and the response of Pharaoh and the ability of the Pharaoh to turn the Hebrew people against each other and therefore to spoil the Hebrew liberation movement for a while is very instructive. And when I sit back in the corner and listen to black people and Puerto Rican people talking about their struggles for justice in the South Bronx, you know, they talk that kind of language. They say, how come we're always letting the man divide us, always turning us against each other to fight for the crumbs under the table? And the only person who gets anything out of that are the people who wanted to oppress us in the first place. You know, when are we going to find our unity together? Well, that exactly happens in a very deliberate kind of way here in chapter 5, that Moses and Aaron come before the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh, and say, let my people go. It's time. You've had us long enough. God has said, we're going, and we're getting ready to go. And the Pharaoh laughed and said, who's this king? Who's this lord who's going to get you out of here? And Moses and Aaron replied, Moses stuttering and Aaron talking good, the God of the Hebrews has revealed himself to us. Allow us to travel 3 days in the desert. So the shucking and jiving begins there. You know, we only want to go out for 3 days, but once you're out, we're going all the way. And if we don't do so, he will kill us with disease. So, you know, it's to your own interest, Pharaoh, to let us go out there because you won't have us as slaves. But the Pharaoh said, how come these people got time to go out and pray? That's almost as bad as having time to have babies. And make them work harder. You know, they're obviously getting stirred up. So he said, what do you mean by making the people neglect their work? Get those slaves back to work. You people have become more numerous than the Egyptians. You're multiplying like rabbits. And now you want to stop working. And so then the straw law was put into effect. Remember that neat piece of legislation? That the straw that was needed for making bricks by the Hebrew slaves was taken from them. They was gathered and it was come brought to them by some other means. It doesn't say how. But now that was taken from them, they would have to go out and gather their own straw, that is to increase their work, but the quota of bricks to be made per day would not be reduced. And the reaction of the Hebrew workers at that point, the slaves, just before that, verse 5:17, I just think is such a repetition. It's such a making fun of us and some of the way some of our people talk when they talk about black people and Puerto Rican things. When they said, why are you doing to this, Your Majesty? And the king answers, you are lazy and you don't want to work. And that's why you want to ask me to let you go out and offer sacrifices to the Lord. You know, if you weren't so busy, you wouldn't be complaining all the time. And that's when the straw law begins. And in the last verse of, verse 20, 21, as they were leaving, that is the workers, they met Moses and Aaron who were waiting for them, and they said to Moses and Aaron, this is the Hebrew workers speaking, the Lord has seen what you have done and will punish you for making the king and the Pharaoh and his officers hate us. You have given them an excuse to kill us. And so the very Hebrew liberation movement that God sent to bring them to the Hebrew slaves who are still living under the mentality is we must endure because God isn't coming yet. They haven't gotten the message yet that Moses is the man that God has sent. And so they figure that this is another one of those false uprisings. This is another one of those many, many, many false messiahs, and we're going to get killed. And so they turn against their own people who are trying to lead them into slavery, into freedom, rather. Well, you know the rest of the story. 10 plagues, each one escalating, the Pharaoh giving in and then coming back, the Pharaoh normally beginning giving in a way in which is really to get them back under control again and not really meaning it. Every time I read the story of the Pharaoh making promises and then backing up on them, I remember
I think back to some personal experiences of back in, I was in Chicago in 1965 and 1966 and working for in the South Side of Chicago for Dr. King and with the movement there, and then there were 18 marches into white communities for integrated housing, and very tumultuous summer, and there were riots in the black community, and every time Mayor Daley was plagued with what was going on there, he would call in his advisors, and that's what the pharaoh does. He calls in his advisors and his priests from the temple, and Mayor Daley would call in the priests and the pastors, white and black, from all around the city, who were involved in the movement, and have a session with Dr. King, and he would make all the promises in the world, you know, based on we have to cool the people off, you know, because they're only hurting themselves. We have to cool the people off and make all the promises in the world in order to get them cool. Then we'll negotiate with them. And so we make all the promise in the world to cool the people off. And sometimes they were literally to cool the people off. They'd give them swimming pools because they figured it was too hot and they'd lose their temper. And that's why they were starting those riots. And they'd give them swimming pools and sprinklers and fire hydrants. And then make all kinds of promises. But when the plague got stopped, as we used to call him, King Daley, would change his mind and say, well, we really need to, we can't do everything at once, we have to. Well, that happened on and on until the final escalation of the Passover and the escape to the Red Sea. And even at that point, it was at that point that the Pharaoh even revealed more than anything else when Moses said, okay, this time we're really gone, get your matzah and pack your suitcases, or they're already packed, just get your suitcases, we're on our way, and headed for the Red Sea, and the Pharaoh, even then, even with the firstborn of all Egypt dead from the Passover, the Pharaoh let his economic, his twisted economic system control him rather than his humanness. And he called out the army, and as he went galloping off in his chariot, his last words were, that's in that very brief speech he makes in chapter, I forgot what it is, says, we cannot let them go, we need them to serve us. The economic system of the Pharaoh of Egypt is dependent upon slavery, dependent upon oppression. And I guess I think that probably one of the questions that is most important for us to ask in our struggling for justice in our society, in the world, in our participation in that, is whether or not that is true for us. That in all of our concern for development of oppressed people in the world, and of poor people in underdeveloped countries and in our own country, and our desire to have them, and we talk language like raise them up to our level, or whatever kind of language we like to use, whether or not there's there's an equation, we need to answer this. And I'm going to tell you that I believe the equation, but I'm not trying to lay that on you. I think we all need to struggle with this, and whether it's true, because it's an extremely important question. Whether or not it's true for us, as it was for the Pharaoh, that freedom and development cannot take place amongst the poor and oppressed people of the world so long as there is an equation saying that we cannot have what we have unless the majority of the world is poor and oppressed. That our richness depends upon the poverty of the world. Whether that economic system requires that relationship, that equal sign. It was true for Pharaoh. Well, I want to ask one other question, and then open it for discussion. And that is, this question I ask, I'll just ask very quickly. I've done this a few times before in the study of Exodus, and what I like to do is take at least the next 2 hours asking this question. So I just want to tell you about the question. And what I like to do is to ask people to take the identity you have today. Your name, your address, your family situation, your race, your class identity, your political and economic circumstances, your personal lifestyles, your values, who you are today. You know, like if I said, stand up and introduce yourself and give me all those things about yourself, and project that back into that story and give yourself a comparable identity there. Take yourself as you are today and go back and live in that story. And to give yourself an identity and then introduce yourself, but not as a 20th century person, but as a 13th century BC person living in that situation, but living in the circumstances you live in today. And that's really fun to do. And what I like to do is have people, just break up in small groups and introduce themselves. And the object of the story is, the object of the question is, but I don't like to tell them that when we're actually doing it, is to find out whether or not they make themselves into Hebrews or Egyptians. And it's usually sort of evenly divided, so we always have a good fight. You know, I will not become an Egyptian. I haven't tested this scientifically, but my experience of this after having done this a lot of times is that the more theological training you've had, the more you want to become a Hebrew. My personal belief is that for us to fully understand the meaning of the Exodus story is that we've got to reread that story from the point of view of Pharaoh. That we have to come to grips with the fact that when we de-spiritualize that story and re-politicize that story to what it originally was, that we have to come to grips with the fact that if we were alive at the time of Exodus, doing what we are doing now, we would be citizens of Egypt and subjects of Pharaoh. That we are part of an oppressor people. You may want to struggle with that. I don't mean that you and I want to be oppressors. You know, and I believe, and I think you go back into that story and study it, and you'll find out that there are liberal Egyptians. A lot of those priests that were advisors of Pharaoh were listed as priests of Pharaoh who were friends of Moses. Another place they're talking about the seventh plague when Moses says, "Hide your cattle because they're all going to die." He actually goes to his friends, and not only to the Hebrew people, but also to his friends who are Egyptians, says, "Hide your cattle too." And the ones who respected Moses hid their cattle so that they wouldn't die. So there's a lot of, I'm not trying to play a big, heavy guilt trip on everybody here. I'm an Egyptian too. I have a lot of fun introducing myself when I go through this game, introducing myself as a priest in the temple in Egypt, and I like to, I've created a church. It's called the First Church of Ramses II. and I like to tell the whole thing if we had time. It's just really fun to just sit back and reread that story and pretend I'm Pharaoh and tell you what happened. And I was going to do that this morning, but I thought I'd rather get this orientation. If we had another hour, I'd like to just sort of tell you the story more authentically, as though I were a priest in the First Church of Ramses II. Because I can't be Pharaoh. I try to be messianic, I know. I've got a very big ego, but I can't pretend that I'm Pharaoh. A lot of people try to pretend they're Moses when they project that thing. And I say, what are you doing in your life today that makes you look like Moses? Or a friend of mine, Vivian Jenkins Nelson, whom some of you may know from the ALC offices, a black woman who works in DLMC in issues of racism and sexism. When she does, we co-lead a lot of racism, anti-racism training programs. And when we do the Exodus game, anybody who wants to be Hebrew, she just looks at us and says, "You don't look black to me." And a lot of us want to be identified with. We want to get out of that very embarrassing identity. But what I'm suggesting is that if we want to serve God and the struggle for justice and wholeness in our world is coming to grips with our identity and not pretending about it. It's that disguising ourselves. We have the power to disguise ourselves with our possessions and our accomplishments and our Jordache genes to make it look like we are not broken and in need of being rescued from our oppressor status and made whole again. I from my own experience, when I first used to start working in the late 50s and early 60s in black communities and started learning about what our people have done, and I went through all that period of denial and disguise and embarrassment and hatred of what it means to be white, and thank the Lord for some black people who brought me through that. But I went through a period of my life when I wanted spent almost all of my effort pretending I was black. You know, I learned to talk black and walk black and think black and hate white. You know, and until some black people very graciously, you know, one on each arm and gently led me in front of a mirror. So what do you see? And don't you know that when you talk that way about your people, you're talking that way about yourself? And there is no possibility of liberation when you hate yourself like that. Well, there's another thing I like to tell too that's a lot of fun, and that is I like to give a long description of the church of a church convention of the First Church of Ramses II. and of how concerned Egyptian religious people tried to deal with the Hebrew problem. And couldn't get anywhere until they changed their assumptions, because it's the so easy assumption for us to get into as liberal Egyptians that it's the Hebrew people who need to be changed. And got rid of that assumption. That we have a Hebrew problem, and that it's the Hebrew people who need to be changed. And that the only way they're going to get changed is if we liberal Egyptians get ourselves together and work on the Pharaoh to help them change. Whereas the assumption of the Hebrew liberation movement is that there wasn't a Hebrew problem, there's an Egyptian problem. And the Egyptians were the ones who needed to be changed. Stopped, if you will. And that the first step of the first step of Hebrew liberation was changing, taking away the power, not does the Pharaoh have the power to change and be nice to the Hebrews, but taking away the power of the Pharaoh to have any decision at all over the Hebrews. Now that was just the beginning of their liberation. They had 40 years to get their own selves together, but the first step was, they couldn't do any of the rest until the first step was taken, and that is changing the Pharaoh. Well, if you go back and read that, if you want to, and read it with a conscious identity of being Egyptian, and there's so many questions that come to mind, like how does our understanding of Hebrews and concern for their plight change? How do our feelings change about the Pharaoh? Up until now, we've been taught to hate the Pharaoh. Now he's one of our people. You know. Would you now be in favor of the Hebrews leaving? Or would you rather have some kind of a transformation and internal development so they could become a better part of our society? Would you want to change the ending and avoid the catastrophe at the Red Sea? Remember, up until now, we've been calling that a victory. When you're an Egyptian, it becomes a catastrophe. Certainly we wouldn't want to join in lustily singing Miriam's new top 10 hit song, "Great is God and greatly to be praised, horse and rider he is thrown into the sea." Well, let me stop there with just a couple of concluding questions, and it's returning to my original principle of saying that a biblical interpretation of the Bible being a third world book or written from the point of view and in the context of oppressed people, if you were an Egyptian, where would you have to go to hear the word of God? If you were an Egyptian and wanted to participate in the struggle for justice, who would you have to follow? You have to follow the lead of the Hebrew people. And then the hard question. If you were an Egyptian and wanted the Hebrews to go free, you'd have to be hoping for the Pharaoh to lose. You have to be hoping for your own people to lose. Or is the Pharaoh losing the only way the Egyptians have a chance to win and recover what it means to be human, by losing the ability to be oppressors. That's pretty hard. Dietrich Bonhoeffer used to talk about it. Pretty hard to pray for the defeat of your own people in order that your own people can be free again. Okay. Any questions? We have how much time? Oh, I'm kidding. I always do that. We have 8 minutes for questions, if you want. So I thought I went up to, I thought it read, I hate these digital watches. I can't read them.
How much of an account of the Exodus appears in writing from Egypt?
I'm sorry?
How much of an account of the Exodus or a mention of the Exodus appears in any written record from Egypt?
None whatsoever.
There's none whatsoever.
I don't think so. Is anybody else?
No,
as far as I'm... Yeah, right, right. The when the victor writes the history, the victory of the oppressed quickly escapes from their books. There are accounts of the presence of the Hebrew people in the Egyptian accounts, but not of their
nothing of their leaving.
How do they account for the leaving? I mean, they're not there.
They don't. There's just nothing there, and nobody's even sure about how big of an impact that even had. It had on Egyptian life. It may have just been a relatively minor thing sometimes. How much in the history books 100 years from now in the United States, how much will our defeat in Vietnam be part of our history? I don't know. It's very important to us today.
Yeah, would you just sketch briefly how our being, remaining who we are, depends upon this big mass of the world remaining poor and poverty-stricken.
Could you ask that again? I'm sorry.
Yeah, you may say to me, you know, that for us to be, to continue to be how we are and enjoy what we have, you know, it depends upon the bulk of the world remaining poor. And would you just sketch how that works, how that is?
Yeah, to sketch that requires
a long time.
A long time. I've become convinced in about 10 years ago, and I have to give this as a part of how it happened to me, because I don't want to get into a long academic description, although that can be done too. About 10 years ago, as a result, as a matter of fact, what happened in 1967, I think it was, one of the most dramatic things in my life was when Dr. Martin Luther King connected the struggle for racial justice in the United States and the struggle to end the racist war in Vietnam, and said they were one and the same struggle. And it was immediately after that he was assassinated. And every advisor to the movement said he shouldn't do it because it would hurt his own cause. But his own integrity about that, about the relationship between those two, would not let him deny the truth, what seemed like the truth to him. And that had a tremendous effect on me. And I spent, after 1970, and for a whole decade, my personal commitment is domestic justice, racial justice in the United States. But I've spent a lot of time in this decade, because of that influence in my life, trying to understand the third world struggle for justice and its relationship to struggles in the United States, that it is a global struggle for justice and not one here and one there. And so I've spent a lot of time personally doing a lot of research and travel in Latin America and Africa, and a lot of research, and I've become convinced that at least through two major dynamics, or three major dynamics, one is that most of the primary raw resources of third world countries, if they were used for the development of those people, there would be another whole development story. When we talk development, we're talking about the trickle-down theory of their getting some benefits for being paid for taking their resources and bringing it to us. The second is third world labor in the manufacturing process and the development process of manufactured goods, the heavy use of it in terms of the labor, not only the resources, but the labor of the people is primarily used to produce something for us. It greatly reduced costs for us because of the very cheap labor. 25 cents an hour is the average price for a South African mining gold that comes to Europe. And thirdly, the third world as a major distributor, we were talking about technology a little bit last night. I don't know if we got into this because I came in late, but the third world as a major as an increasingly great distribution point for our technologically produced goods, and so that they are distributed, and all three of those things have some benefit to the third world peoples, but not development benefits, survival benefits. And all three of those are crucial elements in the development of the development and furthering and sustaining of the later stages of conglomerate capitalism in multinational corporations, and as a major means of sustaining the lifestyle that we have. You can also go back and trace that in the historical basis of the development of and ask the question, to what extent the development of our very successful capitalism comes from the primary first level ripoff of the explorers and the exploiters of the conquistadores, for example, in Latin America, and the colonial development of Africa, of the taking of the basic resources needed for the development of a capital so that you can begin to live in a new way from there in order to develop capitalism here. The dependent relationships, that's a personal story. We spend a lot of time talking about what I've learned from people who really put that down in footnotes and really based that on a very concrete kind of way.